Brad Rutan, welcome back to the podcast.
It's good to be back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. All right, let's jump right into it. So as we enter 2024, where does the market stand as a function of where the market sits? So I think about the last 2 years. We had the inflation ambush of 2022, where all financial assets derated because your cash rate went up and now everything's worth a little bit less, right? Okay. So 2023 comes along. You have falling inflation, which is a function of, you know, the base effect. So there was going to be falling inflation.
Expected.
Yep, yeah. Expected. But you also had a significant amount of destocking, not in services, but in capital goods. So here we are today, and what we've seen particularly over the last 3 months, tremendous strength in risk assets, right, from equities to credit. I'd like to know, you didn't see commodities participate in that, but we'll shelve that for a second.
Separate topic.
Yep, separate topic. Yields came down dramatically, and those two things are related. So where does the market stand? And what the market is telling us, and that's where I want your view on, is the market thinks it's going to get a bunch of rate cuts next year. The market believes inflation's going to fall. The market believes we're going to avoid a recession. And you're going to get an acceleration in earnings growth. Now, one of those things, or two or three of those things, may indeed happen, but I find it very unlikely you're going to get all four.
That'd be winning the lottery.
Yes. All four. So what are we missing?
Right. I mean, I think when yields went down last year, late last year, that was based purely on Fed pivot messaging, right? They took that and ran with it. Mm-hmm. And maybe too much, right? They probably priced in too much of a Fed pivot. So, and that obviously allowed risk assets from equities and bonds and everything to participate.
Which was just a re-rating.
It's all it was.
Because there wasn't earnings growth.
There was nothing.
Earnings estimates were actually coming down. So you had a massive re-rating, which was all rate Fed pivot driven.
All based on
that. Okay, go ahead.
So then for one, that is all that correctly priced in? Right. So did we price in too much? And for to continue for rates to go down, it would be based on economic weakness.
Right.
And Fed cutting. But how do you get earnings growth
with economic weakness?
Exactly.
Right. Those things don't really live
those
together.
Things don't match to me.
Yeah.
At all.
So volatility is the market adjusting for mistaken assumptions.
Correct.
So there's a lot of positive assumptions being made, right? A lot of things that have to come together. And you know, my inclination is always on the more cautious side. I think that's somewhat evolutionary, right? So you had that hunter-gatherer who was always cautious, negative. Right. He worried about a saber-toothed tiger.
It served a purpose,
yeah. Right? So I think that's in our DNA. But when it comes to financial assets, particularly late cycle, it's the opposite. It seems that the evolutionary bias is very positive. What's going to break will matter, and it's going to matter a lot in terms of what specific breaks. So first, let's talk about rates. You know, we're recording this podcast early to mid-January. 10-year Treasury somewhere in and above 4%, give or take. I'm not going to pin you down to what's the right terminal value for this, but just maybe walk us through where should long rates, generally speaking, live?
I mean, I think you're plus or minus 50 bips of that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to believe that the 10-year could get back to 5 and stay there.
Well, then let's walk through why. What would have to happen for that?
I mean, I think you would need to see incredible
acceleration growth, inflation.
Right? You'd also need to see the supply demand metrics change. But if you got,
so you mean term premium?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because okay. But if you got there, could you stay there?
Right.
Or could you stay at? Do you think the 10-year could stay at 5.5 for a full year?
Right. So for technical reasons, you can flirt up there like it did midsummer.
It can flirt. It just, and then what happened, right? It just came right off it.
When I think about the 10-year trade, I think of it like a financial asset, like any other financial asset, right? It's the expected rate of growth and inflation over the next 10 years. And I think a lot of investors anchor it to its Fed funds out 10 years. But it doesn't work like that, at least not in my experience.
No.
And so what kind of environment where you're the economic growth or inflation backdrop where you're a sustained 5% looking out over the next 10 years, it seems hard.
It's hard to imagine, right? I mean, we haven't even fully felt the effect of the most aggressive Fed tightening. You know, you've made some great comments about rates over a longer period of time, right? We have 5,000 years of rate data out there.
That's right. Yeah, Bank of England did that work.
Yeah, and it's an incredible work, but we haven't fully felt that. I mean, people, because when rates go from, when mortgage rates go to 8, it doesn't mean everyone's buying a house. I mean, most people didn't buy a house. So a lot of people haven't felt the effect of those higher rates yet.
Yeah.
It's just hard to see. I mean, I think maybe the deep recession's off the table, the hard landing might be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Or that's what maybe the market thinks. I mean, I think worst case scenario right now is a mild recession, I'd say.
Yeah. And I'm not an economist. You're not an economist. I don't think that's an incorrect view from the standpoint of, you know, I've got to keep it really simple, but a recession, something's receding, right? Correct. So what recedes economically is something that was overbuilt, overbought, overproduced, right, in the real economy. And throughout the 2010s, the reason you had economic stagnation, disinflation, if not deflation, was the consumer retrenched, banks retrenched, right? Your two major engines of economic growth and inflation. So as people and banks were repairing their balance sheet, that's not where the excess is today. So I think for that reason, it just strikes me as, you know, you can take the deep economic recession off the table, but then where was the excess?
Right.
The excess is it's elsewhere. And I think, or we think, as we've talked about before, it was in balance sheets and financial leverage. So you can have a mild or maybe avoid an economic recession. And maybe now we're jumping ahead to a different topic, but doesn't mean you can't have a profit recession.
No, and it doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of companies that are going to suffer, right? I mean, I actually used that quote, Miles Law, because, you know, when you're staring at a wall from five blocks away, you see a brick wall. When you get up close to it, you see bricks,
right?
And you know, is there a maturity wall? That's one thing we talk about.
Well,
you know, maybe, but more it's the bricks, right? So there's plenty of companies that aren't going to be able to handle the stress. They're in a race against time. Can the Fed bail them out by cutting soon enough and enough to basically save them? So, hard recession, hard landing, maybe it's out. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be a lot of opportunities to avoid companies that are in pretty bad health today.
So let's pivot. So from a rate dynamic, right? So we're taking maybe a collapse in interest rates off the table, assuming we're going to avoid a deep recession. We're going to take the 5-handle plus off the table because this doesn't seem to be the growth catalyst for that.
Right.
So let's maybe jump to credit, corporate risk, balance sheet risk, which you're alluding to. I guess what strikes me, and I've been using this, I love the fable that David Foster Wallace used in his commencement speech, which it just screams the ubiquity of the environment that you're living in, right? So the fable, if you remember real quick, there's two little fish swimming along, an older, more mature fish coming the other way. He says to the two younger fish, "Hey, how's the water, boys?" The two fish look at him confusingly, ignore him, swim along. Later, one fish says to the other, "What the heck is water?" And what that screams to me is the paradigm that you're living in, just like the two fish in the water, it's hard to realize, right? And what's even more difficult to realize, more ubiquitous, is when it's changing. And if you think about the paradigm that owners of capital or investors or maybe society lived in, it was one of disinflation, one of central bank repression of interest rates, which transferred wealth from savers to borrowers' leveraged income streams. And I think this is where you're going with this, is balance sheets that maybe flourished under that regime are going to struggle under a different regime. And not that the Fed won't cut interest rates, but we're not going back to the prior regime.
Right. We're not going back to zero interest rate policy, right? And you make a great point, because I think a lot of investors and clients even, you know, that the great financial crisis is the beginning of their memory of the markets, right? It's, what was that, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
And that paradigm, that ubiquitous, like this, that's what we lived in. And it's changing. Yeah. And right, we're not going to go back to zero interest rate. And let's say the Fed cuts four times this year. That's still a very different environment for companies to live in that need capital, and consumers too.
Yeah. And even if they do cut rates, that doesn't mean the long end is going to come down.
It doesn't.
Right? So, and that's where companies borrow.
And I think it's, you know, personally ridiculous to think they could cut in March. You know, why would they cut in March, right? I mean, this whole pricing of cuts starting in March and six cuts next year, right? It doesn't make any sense to me. We can get into it.
Yeah, it seems aggressive.
It's very aggressive, but they're going to cut. I think we can agree that there's going to be a few cuts, but that's not going back to that paradigm we're in.
So that's where it just strikes me. So like the two fish in the fable, who don't know what water is, right? We were in an environment of suppressed interest rates, which makes everything more investable.
Correct.
Right? Makes everything, there's less discretion. So we really don't know.
It's easier.
It's easier, right? Yeah. We really don't know the extent or the level of bad ideas that got funded. But we're going to find out, to your point earlier about the delayed effects of interest rates.
And that's the beauty of it, right? I mean, that's why you and I get up in the morning.
Yeah.
Is eventually those bad ideas get found out.
Yeah.
Right. And eventually you get rewarded for avoiding them.
Yeah. Well, in economic terms, right, it's capital is moving from, you're taking away from an incompetent person, give it to an incompetent person. I mean, that's effectively what happens.
That's exactly what happened. But yeah, this is exciting. Right. I mean, listen, we can agree that this year might, looking back, let's say we have a recession, the market itself, you know, might be down. I have no idea.
Yep.
Right. But it doesn't mean there aren't going to be great opportunities.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Both to avoid and to invest in companies.
Well, this is where I think I get accused of, you know, being too negative or being too bearish. And because they hear the concern I have about profitability, balance sheets, and valuation.
They're not hearing you correctly then.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Very nice of you. Yeah. No, but when you, I guess, unpack that. So if you take an industry, and we'll just keep it generic, an industry that makes widgets, right? So a made up term. And there's 20 companies in an industry that make up widgets. When you suppress interest rates and you allow weaker companies to compete in an industry that they otherwise would have been competed out of, now they're competing for capital, they're competing for labor, they're competing for customers. So inefficiencies get created. And I think what we're trying to argue is, all right, well, we obviously want to avoid the financial assets of those enterprises because they're just not economically viable,
right?
In a more normalized world, whatever the next regime we're in is going to look like. The positive aspect to me, and it's more of a long-term view, is now you've got competition going away. So if you've got less competition for business and value propositions, you've got greater returns on capital. And there's no law in finance, but sort of one consistency is financial assets follow returns, period, right? It's been that way for centuries. So if I've got 20 companies in an industry that make widgets, and now I have 13, and you know, maybe you're supposed to have eight, maybe you're supposed to have whatever the number is. If you now just have fewer competitors, those companies that, let's call it, maybe survive or benefit from those that get extinguished away, they take that market share. Presumably now they're importing incremental revenues greater than cost. So you get operating leverage and you get higher returns and much better financial outcomes.
And then I'd say even then, now take that 13, right? And now throw in other paradigm shifts like reglobalization, deglobalization, whatever you want to call it. Artificial intelligence, obviously we know it's a big trend. And now that 13, maybe it's 7.
Yeah.
That can leverage those other paradigm shifts and really rise. And that's where it gets exciting.
Let's drill down on both of those. And I want to make sure we come back to your views on credit asset classes.
Yeah.
So let's talk about globalization first. So some economists or people call it deglobalization. I think that's probably an overstatement because it's just shifting.
Re-globalization.
Right? Yeah, it's just it's changing. But here's how I approach it very simply. So, you know, 30 years ago, China was a near bankrupt country, and countries can't claim bankruptcy, but just, you know, from an accounting standpoint.
Yeah, right.
And globalization allowed them to become a massive manufacturing engine of the world. And I would argue it didn't allow developed market companies to become massive. It basically forced them.
Forced them.
Right? Yeah. Because you're not going to be able to compete with our cheap labor. Right. So what it did was it created huge economic growth in China, but it deflated capital spend in developed markets. It deflated labor prices, which has an inverse relationship with returns on capital, which is why financial asset prices did so well. So a lot like the paradigm of interest rates, what's also changed now is obviously globalization. So tell me your perspective on that and your views.
I mean, I think ever since World War II, right, we had that massive trend of globalization you talk about. And it's really been, I think, since maybe 2011, 12, we started to see that come off. First, maybe due to some nationalism, COVID really kickstarted because supply chains broke down. And now you have a situation where, like, Chinese wages are up 300, 400%. And now Mexico is the number one trading partner with the U.S. as of today. Canada is number two. So China's not even, you know, they're behind the European Union. And it's whether it's onshoring, nearshoring, friendshoring, reglobalization, whatever you want to term it. If I'm a CEO, I want a secure supply chain. Yep. And is it really that much cheaper to produce it in China? It's probably not. I can you know, friendshore to Mexico or to Canada. And then throw in, you know, recent events in the Red Sea, right? It just makes all the more sense for companies. Now, what is that? Is it inflationary or disinflationary, right? Inflationary maybe short term because it takes capital to onshore.
Yep. And people.
But longer term for those companies that can successfully create a better supply chain, you know, an Airbus 380 has 14 million parts. They come from 1,500 different companies from 30 different countries. Is that really the best way to produce an airplane? I don't know.
Right.
You don't know, but it seems like a pretty huge spider web supply chain that I think companies are trying to manage down away from China to other countries.
Well, and it just strikes me, you know, you went from a paradigm of very low growth and very high returns on capital.
Correct.
Right? And those two things are absolutely related. So as growth was falling weak post-global financial crisis, people weren't spending money, banks weren't lending, and there was a vicious cycle taking place as labor and production was being moved offshore. All that drove up
returns,
right? So now what's happening is you're going from just-in-time delivery to just-in-case, right? And that was a function of COVID, right? I'd much rather have a product on the shelf at a slightly lower margin than not have it on the shelf at a maximum margin, right? It takes something like 5,000 or 6,000 parts to make a car. It takes one part to not. So to your point, reshoring or reglobalization, it's for supply chain resiliency, but there's going to be some margin give up in that because of the spend.
Right. Returns. Right.
Returns.
It's the opposite.
Yeah.
To your point, you're not, the fish isn't in the water anymore.
Yeah.
You go from a low growth, high return because you're outsourcing. Now that goes in reverse. And again, that 13 companies, how many of them, in your example, you know, can manage that process?
Yeah. Well, do they have the capital? If they don't, can they borrow it? And what's the price? Because capital is no longer scarce and cheap.
No. And some are still relying on China. They have to be, you know, rare minerals. But all this is what, and I know you and I can geek out about this, but what's so exciting about meeting with companies right now and asking them how they're addressing this, how are you handling AI, and then creating that mosaic of information across industries to see how is this all playing together? To your point, it has to be a lower return overall environment. Doesn't mean we can't make money.
Right.
But that artificial
return. It just gets harder. It requires discretion. I think when you mentioned AI, let's go there. Then we'll jump into expectations on asset classes. So there's always two sides to every coin.
Right.
And I think what's not being discounted in financial markets.
Not always. My son's magic kit has a one
side. Oh, no coin. Kidding. Well, yeah. I'd like to see that.
It's a good trick.
Well, perhaps then AI similarly just has a one-sided right. coin, which is that it's going to increase productivity for everyone.
Correct.
Now, I don't discount the step function change and production powers that it's going to bring to society. You know, I don't know what they are exactly, and I don't think anybody does, but it's going to be terrific, I'm sure. The flip side to that is, what is technology? It's removes something. It removes frictions in society. Right?
Makes things easier.
Makes things easier.
Less expensive.
Yep. So what gets lost in that, I think, the current AI conversation is the revenue stream that's associated with the frictions of the past
Correct.
Or that we live with now
right.
that go away.
Right.
And then more importantly, who are the companies tied to that?
Exactly.
Right.
And then it gets to, you know, we talk about the Mag 7 so much, right? I mean, those are companies with massive moats, and their sole goal is to protect those moats at all costs. Like, can they, you can make a case, some will and some won't.
Yeah, some will, some can't.
But it's more interesting, yeah, those other companies.
Yeah.
Right? That those non-Mag 7,
yeah.
how are they going to fare? And are those revenue streams, to your point, going to disappear?
Well, the market, to me, maybe this is why the market is discounting both falling inflation, interest rate cuts, and elevated EPS growth, because it believes that there's going to be massive productivity gains from, you know, AI. And I guess what I would rebut with, or what I do rebut with, is productivity gains typically get competed away. So in other words, back to the widget example, you've got 20 companies and maybe three of them are gone because they were over-levered and they can't, you know, they've got an imbalanced balance sheet that just can't be corrected. Maybe another three of them go away, to your point earlier, or they can't re-globalize appropriately. And maybe another three go away because not because they have an over-levered balance sheet or because they've got stretched supply chains and without access to capital, but simply because their product isn't good enough, right? Because somebody else's product is made better by their AI.
Right. Yeah. And it's everyone from healthcare to financial services.
Oh, every industry.
It's every industry.
Every industry.
And that, but that's where I think, and obviously we're biased, but to be able to then cross that information,
mm-hmm.
right? And find out what's the second derivative effect of what's the next cash flow attached to that cash flow in the supply chain that could be affected and then aggregate all the information.
Yeah. Well, yeah, right. You're selling coffee and, you know, just hypothetically, you're selling a widget, and how are you going to use AI to make the widget sale more efficient? But perhaps that allows you and I, who've got a better widget, but we didn't have the capital to create the widget company. But now AI allows us to compete, or it lowers the barriers to entry, I think, in what was probably seemingly before uncontestable profit pools.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting. And I'm by no means an artificial intelligence expert.
No, me neither.
But reading the research being done, it's just been fascinating to see the scope and how quick it's happening compared to past, you know, paradigm shifts.
So let's switch to credit.
Yep.
So we talked about rates. So maybe the tails are probably off the table. Deep recession, inflation that drives high mid-single digit rates. So your rate market's fairly priced, reasonably attractive. Let's talk about credit. Where along the credit spectrum, in the context of everything that we've talked about today, where are you talking about with clients? Where's their opportunities? Where's their risks?
I mean, if you're looking at 12-month view, and we have mild recession on the table, I mean, it's possible that you see some spread widening that's larger than you see rates coming down.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that falls short of the opportunity, because when you're buying, let's say, a fund or an ETF with a yield to worst of 6.
Okay.
It's not a 12-month yield, right? That's baking in the price of the bonds and the coupon.
Yeah.
And
to maturity,
right? So let's call it to 6 years. So if you can look out past this year, I mean, I do think there's an opportunity in bonds. That being said, high yield, investment grade, they're not pricing in recession. mean, that there's mispriced if we are having a recession.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it could be rocky between now and year end, but from a yield perspective, when's the last time we were given this opportunity with our starting yields, you know, 6-7. So, you know, short term, high quality, short investment grade bonds, you know, if we can push out the time horizon a bit, multi-sector bond funds, we think of great opportunity.
Yeah. Well, as you know, I work on a couple different multi-sector income funds, and just for compliance purposes and disclosure, I'm not going to mention the names and any of that, but I've been overweight fixed income and underweight equities for some time. So how I'm positioned is consistent with what you're talking about. Similarly, within that, the bulk of the overweighting is in the rate market, which we talked about earlier.
Right.
I just have a hard time envisioning a sustained elevated mid-single digit, you know, sovereign bond yield, right? So I like that market, particularly from the standpoint of risk versus reward.
So what's then your concern with credit?
Default.
Yeah.
It's just, you were highlighting the area. Right. So, but that said, I'm overweight investment grade corporates.
Right.
So I'm overweight there, just less so.
Yep.
But that won't last, right? Meaning I will aggressively move into that as spreads start to, you know, widen out a little bit. And I think reflect more of a balanced risk versus reward reality.
I think that's the secret, right? Is you have some dry powder. You know, we think things will get moderately worse.
Yep.
You're going to get a better buying opportunity. It's the defaults. How many of these companies are going to be able to survive that race with the Fed?
Yeah.
That's what keeps us slightly pessimistic.
Yeah. Well, it just seems, though, that there is, a lot of projects get funded. I use that term as a catch-all.
Right.
Right. Businesses, projects, ideas, et cetera. A lot of projects. Everybody got capital. You need a capital. You got it. And so whether it's public, private, I think there's more of that risk in the private space. But nonetheless,
agreed.
There was a lot of excess funding. And so even though you might have a high quality asset in high yield, it will get dragged out, right, with the rest of the market as default rates start to pick up. 2023, we ended with a significant number of bankruptcies in the United States. That it wasn't as high as it was during the pandemic or as high as it was in 08, but it was pretty close. So I think what's already happening, not at the S&P 500 level, but what's happening is, well, default rates are quietly rising in high yield. You're seeing increasing bankruptcy rates in the United States, and the size of the companies filed for bankruptcies are rising too. There was a big one this week too.
Yeah.
I won't say it for compliance, but a massive one.
Huge.
And I think that manifests itself. But to your point, yes, it's very, very good and attractive bonds. So I trust that we're going to pick those right ones. But as those spreads start to widen out a bit, I will be aggressive and I'll shift from rate market into the credit market.
And I think to your point, I don't think investors are ready for that. I don't think they're expecting, obviously, if they're expecting significant rate cuts, inflation to come down, earnings growth to go up, right? Then de facto, they can't be expecting high yield default rates to be 6-7%. And I'm not saying they're going to get there. What gives me hope is that there's going to be plenty of companies that default, but it's avoiding them. Right. I mean, that's our job.
Discretion.
Discretion.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Anything we didn't cover that you want to talk about in fixed income or market sentiment, things you're worried about, things you're excited about?
I mean, I'm still worried at the amount of cash out there, right? Just the amount of cash that is not invested. And I get it.
Worried from the standpoint of?
From people staying in it. For another year, right? Missing out on opportunities. I'm not saying that this year is going to be the greatest year for investing, but if you don't get
it. I see. Yeah. For the opportunity cost for those investors that are, yes.
Correct. Because, cash rates are going to go down.
Yeah.
I think investors today will be better served, investing versus waiting until the end of the year for the all clear.
Right.
That's something, but that's from a client facing and market facing perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that with credit markets. I don't understand that view as it pertains to equity markets.
Yeah.
Because, price is what you pay, but valuation is what you get.
Right.
And the price is really high in the equity market and the quality is not very good.
Right. It's a different conversation.
It's a different conversation.
Yeah. I guess deficit, you know, something obviously, you know, debt in the U.S. is something that keeps me up at night, both as a dad and an investment.
Well, from a market risk standpoint, you know, what doesn't get talked about a lot is, you know, financial repression round two, right? So
you think it's possible?
Oh, yeah. Well, rich and powerful people will do anything to stay rich and powerful. Right. So I guess what I worry about is not the ability to cut rates, because I don't think the bond market will allow it, but you rewrite the laws. So you force your government, forces saving institutions to buy their debt,
right,
to cap. So that's kind of one reason why I don't think yields are going to go to those levels that some people were worried about.
Right.
Because I think policymakers will just rewrite the law. I mean, you saw that in 08.
Yep.
Right. So you force saving institutions to buy sovereign bonds. So if you're going to buy something, you have to sell something on the other side.
It's really not outside the realm of possibilities, no, right?
It's not a zero probability.
It's not. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see.
Yeah. So I think that would create some volatility for certain in risk markets. But again, water finds its right level. So as long as the cash flow generating capability of the enterprise that you're financing, right, they're able to generate revenues and meet and fulfill debt obligations, those bonds might widen out, to your point earlier, but they're going to be fine. Right. So you're taking a short-term view by sitting in cash and not thinking about what a high-grade corporate bond portfolio or what have you can offer.
You might be down 4% by the end of the year, but is that bond going to pay off in 5 years is the real question, right? Yeah.
And when you look through that over in your example earlier, at the six-year period, you're doing materially better.
Right, then if you had done this back in 2011, 12, you know, 13, when rates and spreads were so low. So that's my kind of backdrop for credit is, I get it. Like, there's a ton of default risk and credit risk out there.
Yep.
If you can avoid it, which is our job.
Yep.
Right? And your starting point is attractive and you can look out 5 years. I see the opportunity. Equity market is a different animal.
Right. Makes sense. All right, Brad, let's put a bow on it. Thank you.
Let's do this again.
Appreciate it.
All right. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
The views expressed are those of the speaker and are subject to change at any time. These views are for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a recommendation to purchase any security or as an offer of securities or investment advice. No forecast can be guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results.